In Mountain View, California this week, a new exhibit is opening. It's at the Computer History Museum, and it's called Revolution, the First 2,000 Years of Computing. The exhibit was more than 6 years in the making, a lifetime in computer years. But unlike most technological enterprises, it doesn't look forward, but back, way back. Reporter Corey Takahashi visited the museum and brings us this report.
The Computer History Museum has some very well-known neighbors.
So Google is just to the east of us. Just to the south of us is Microsoft's Silicon Valley campus.
But exhibition launch director Paul Conley will be the first to tell you that this region, it's by no means the center of the computing world. Not if you take the long view.
The story of computing is very much international, and that is a thread that goes through the entire exhibit, all the way from Chinese abacuses, the Japanese version of an abacus, which is called a soroban, all the way up to PCs, and even the web, because France had an early version of the web, which was called the Minitel system, which has since been completely eclipsed by the web.
All of this is on display, the serious, the mathematical, and the whimsical. For instance, an original Pong machine from 1972, which is one of the earliest examples of a video game. Then there are archaic census machines and Cold War-era defense and radar systems, complete with built-in ashtrays for the Air Force personnel who watch them. There are also videos and soundtracks designed to engage the less geeky. One of the curators, Alex Bohanek, has a soft spot for the exhibition's obsolete items.
Machines like the Swedish ABC Luxor 802 or this Kookaburra laptop from an Australian company. This Smacky 6 is Swedish. This Amstrad is British, as is the Sinclair Spectrum. And this Dragon 32 is maybe the only computer ever mass-produced in Wales. It's a clone of the Tandy Radio Shack, the color computer, the Coco.
The Revolution exhibition is roughly chronological. As you step in deeper, beyond the hardware breakthroughs of World War II and the Cold War, the focus increasingly shifts to themes like artificial intelligence and data.
Computer-generated data.
And the virtual world and software.
It's the idea that people now tinker less with building hardware and more with building software. And to build software, you need programming languages. And programming is something that to a lot of people who are not in the computing field is somewhat of a black art. It's somewhat magic.
To demystify that magic, the exhibition has a family tree of programming languages. It dates back to 1954. The chart features about 150 of the thousands of programming languages invented worldwide.
You already see here Fortran, Lisp, Snowball, Algol, Simula, Basic, Pascal, Smalltalk. All of these are already many languages. A programming language itself, just like a spoken language, has a syntax, a semantics. It has certain conventions on how it's used.
Programming languages are used in everything from automated banking to website building. This diversity of use is the reason so many exist.
You don't want to have just one language. And that was an idea early on in programming languages, that there's going to be this one language that solves all problems. And it's similar in the spoken language community as well, with things like Esperanto and so forth. But oftentimes there are nuances you cannot very easily express.
Even computer scientists get confused.
The English word call, which is a common statement in all programming languages, when it was pronounced by Germans in a German context, sounded like the German word cabbage.
Gio Wiederhold is an emeritus professor at Stanford University. He started the campus's own computer exhibition, which shares items with the Computer History Museum. Wiederhold says it's more difficult to capture computer history than, say, art history. He says the true intellectual value of computing is represented less by artifacts than by ideas and evolving code.
There's one difference between most artifacts and software, namely an artifact, once it exists, it's very hard to change.
What distinguishes beautiful code that should be in a museum from code that should just be tossed in the trash?
Well, some ugly code works, and so it won't be tossed in the trash. But beautiful code is where, just like beautiful text in writing, where somebody can read it, it is clear what is meant.
As a young immigrant programmer, Wiederhold wrote the code for combustion equations in the Polaris missile. He says that code was still in use as recently as a decade ago.
But of course, the software has increased so much in volume. You know, there's millions of lines of code involved, even in an iPhone.
Wiederhold's current research deals with the flow of intellectual property. He says a rapid flow has turned many programming languages into commodities, and it complicates old notions of software authorship.
All languages are converging. We have many fewer languages, you know, than we used to have. So that's a good thing.
A good thing, possibly, for programming languages, even if it's not so good for spoken human languages.
It helps communication a great deal, okay? When people were more narrow, they thought they needed different languages in their own country. And for instance, it means that I can send a program that's written by a programmer here at 6 p.m. to India for somebody to help me in testing and debugging it.
It's a phenomenon called the 24-hour software factory.
The spoken language has become nearly universal English, but the programming languages are completely universal. They're not bound by countries anymore.
Wiederhold hopes exhibitions like Revolution can help to explain these languages so the next generation gets inspired to write new code, perhaps even beautiful, gallery-worthy code. For the world, I'm Corey Takahashi.
We also have an online slideshow of some of the exhibits at the Computer History Museum. Just go to theworld.org.